You know, this is kind of like a holiday vortex or kind of religious vortex. There's of some significance. It's the second week of Lent. It's St. Patrick's Day coming up, which also happens to be Catherine Thanis' birthday. It's the Ides of March. For you astrological types, Mercury is retrograde. I don't know, there's probably other things. I just feel like I should wish you happy daylight savings time. And I really do thank you for coming out this evening. You know, I'm going to kind of operate tonight under my own made-up precept of less is more. And I'd like to talk a little bit about Zazen tonight and about what I would call a kind of deconstructioning or deconstructionist process that happens in meditation. And I've been thinking about this because, you know, I have a friend who, a colleague actually, who's dying of brain cancer. And I go see him about once a week, once every 10 days. He's so far kind of surpassed everyone's expectation. And he started this symptomatically with a series of seizures last February. And he hasn't really left the hospital or a skilled nursing or a hospice place since. And I've been visiting him since about July with a kind of brief hiatus in October and November. And, you know, I feel like I go visit him and we pretend to have conversation, which I don't know if you've ever had this experience, maybe with a, I don't know, someone, you know, who's really hard of hearing and you're not really communicating, or someone who doesn't speak the same language you speak, or in my case, my father, when he had dementia. We would kind of go through the motions and put a lot of effort into it. So finally, the last time I saw him, he was asleep, which is the first time I've seen him asleep. And the staff are running out saying, well, we'll wake him up, we'll wake him up. And I'm like, don't wake him up, that's okay. But they felt like, you know, the only real communication that happens is when someone is talking and you're having this exchange. And I mean, definitely we're having conversations of a sort, but whether or not any real communication was taking place, I don't know, I don't think so. But, and it was sort of confirmed a few months ago when I was alone with him and he looked up at me and he goes, who are you? So all the pretense of like, I'm your colleague, I worked with you for 25 years, we've known each other, blah, 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 it just kind of went out the window. So, and I'm pretty sure the staff at this place thought I was a little weird, because then they came in with lunch and they tried to wake him up. And my friend, he opens his mouth if you put something in front of it, but he doesn't really, I'm not sure he's really hungry. So there's a whole lot of kind of interactions. Anyway, I described it to his hospice chaplain later, who happens to be someone that just coincidentally I know. And I said, it's a little bit like Zazen. You know, something's happening there, even though we're not really talking, and even though we're not really exchanging words or even meaningful glances, you know. And I felt a little bit on my last visit like more was happening there in that quiet and silence than had happened in all my previous visits. So, You know, I've been talking about, in this kind of January through June series of talks, I've wanted to talk about what I think are ethical values and attributes of doing Zen practice. And I'm sorry, Ziggy, could you turn up the lights for me just a little bit? Thank you. And so tonight, as I said, is that all right with everyone? I wanted to talk about meditation as a deconstructionist process. And, you know, we know a lot about meditation from the words and the lectures that you come to. You know, we learn that meditation is the kind of the singular important practice that distinguishes, for example, Soto Zen from some other practices of Buddhism. And you've probably heard or read the very off-sighted saying, you know, to study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be awakened by or realize the 10,000 things, or in other words, kind of grasp or come to terms with kind of the truth of non-self. Or maybe you've heard it kind of around a non-dualism teaching. And, you know, all these words that we use to describe Zazen, I think, for me, they have been very challenging. So I'm just kind of speak from my own viewpoint tonight about this. I know that when I first came to sit, I hadn't heard the words of the Fukansan Zengi or the Genjo Koan or any of the kind of basic things that we might read that tell us something about sitting meditation. The language is beautiful. It's evocative. But for me, the downside has been that it's given my mind something to think about as an endpoint, right? I'm waiting to awaken to the 10,000 things or to really kind of sink into practice realization. And as many of us know, the words are very, they fall short often of the experience of it. But also, I want to emphasize this tonight, that when you think you know where you want to go, your mind claims that product for the end product. And that in itself can be a huge detriment. Actually, I could probably stop right there. That's kind of... you know, because we're such conceptual people, it's really great when someone tells us this stuff or we read this stuff about what's supposed to happen when you sit meditation. And, you know, this is really, in my view, a kind of idealism, because it sort of presents for us a purity about the practice and about what's supposed to happen. And I know, because I'm extremely achievement-oriented, once I heard the words, I couldn't stop thinking about it. I mean, not every time, but I would come back to it and back to it. So I thought tonight I would just give you a few examples of what some of the great Zen teachers have to say about idealism and about Zazen. I was reading, some of you know this person, Frank Ostaseki, who's the author of The Five Invitations. And there was a major death of a priest at San Francisco Zen Center last week, and Frank Ostaseki, he's also, I think he's the founder of Zen Hospice. Do I have that correct? Do you know? He wrote something on Facebook, and he was really talking about kind of how we think about enlightenment, what happens at the time of death, and so on. And he says, and I quote here, "One of the occupational hazards of the spiritual path is idealism. It can be the death of any practice. Sometimes we create and hold too tightly to a spiritual ideal or vision of where we think we should be. And then we use that idea to not be where we are." And then just kind of a couple sentences down, he says, "Meditation doesn't solve your problems. It dissolves them. Our minds are wild. We don't tame them by trying to stop our thoughts, by repressing our emotions or even by resolving our issues. So probably that's not new to you. You've heard some version of this along the way. Let me tell you a little bit about what Shohaku Okamura, as he's writing about Dogen and Zazen, says. You know, I'm a person who reads kind of Dogen in various forms, different translations, and so on. And I know I have always thought that Dogen had a systematic logic to what he does, right? It is this, it is not this, it is not this, not this, right? Have you heard that construction? Okay, so this is what Shohaku Okamura says. Dogen tries to destroy our common logical way of thinking and using concepts. But trying to find Dogen's logic or Dogen's philosophy as another fabricated system is hopeless. Somehow that line gave me great hope. He is simply trying to break our habit of thinking and show us how to see reality before it is processed by our thoughts. And Shohaku Okamura is one who often kind of works with original texts, and he finds kind of a place where things don't all sync up together. And then he says, how can this be? Or he'll say something like, do you believe this? Actually, I don't believe this. Okay, and then finally, I just want to offer you some of what Suzuki Roshi offered at Tassajara kind of back in the old days. This is a lecture, I think, during a practice period, probably Sesshin, in 1971, and he's being very critical of how students are interested in psychology and the use of psychological concepts to understand what we're doing here on the cushion. And he says the following. He says, the way we understand ourselves is quite different from that of psychological understanding. And he gets in a little closer and adds, you say to sit, he does this otherizing thing with all the people that have come down to Tassajara to follow. He says, you guys, you say to sit without thinking too much is difficult. Just to sit is very difficult. But the more difficult thing will be to try to think about yourself. And then he laughs. This is much more difficult. More laughing. Maybe this is easy, you know, but to have some conclusion, you know, when you don't know what to do with yourself, or when you don't know, when you find out it is impossible to know who you are, you know, you become crazy. And I'm not sure he would use that kind of language were he alive today. But I just wanted to, and actually when I read this last line, you become crazy, it made me think about his comradeship and interactions with Trungpa, because one of the movies about Trungpa is called Crazy Wisdom, which was one of the ways that Trungpa described his dharma. So mostly what I want to bring to you this evening is to just say something about my own experience of this. You know, I should say, this is not a pretty process for me. And the experience of the process of deconstructing the self, or deconstruction, and I also want to say this is different than the idea of the destruction of the self or destroying the self. Because I think, you know, the project really, when we're doing this meditation, a lot of people say, well, I felt like I dropped off body and mind. You know, bing, I felt a little zing, and I think that happened. And maybe, maybe not, you know. When you start to put words on what you think the experience was, very quickly I think we get into trouble around this. So in my case, first I also want to add that any deconstruction that has happened, it's still in process. And, you know, in a way I find that a great relief, that I'm not anywhere near done, and I don't want to pretend to be anywhere near or far down this road. And I actually also think that being a senior student or a priest or a teacher or an abbot is no guarantee that you're necessarily very far down this road. No disrespect meant to, you know, any of the senior students or teachers or priests, both in this room, but also kind of in the broader sangha of Soto Zen. And also, as I describe some of my own deconstruction here, you should know that this is not a template, right, for others. This is an individual practice. This is the verification part of the process that you have to sort of do this for your own body and mind and your own zazen and meditation. How would I describe my deconstruction? I would say that it's been very fraught. And I don't want to put it in psychological terms because I don't think it's that. But there was a lot of snot and tears. And then there was a lot of sorrow and grief. I used to say grief is kind of the doorway through which I step and do this work of, you know, studying the self. But actually, I don't know really now, kind of years later, what I call it grief. My expression of it was grief with the snot and the tears and the sorrow and Kleenex. I always have Kleenex in here. But it also manifested as illness and a lot of frustration, some anger. And again, these things don't necessarily have specific, I mean, you know, we always like to tell the story of why we feel the way we do and why tears are about sorrow or why rage is about anger, or any of the other kind of emotional or affective states have this cause. It typically, you know, it's pretty convenient to go back to your childhood and pick on your parents for this, of course. But I think at some point during the process of doing this deconstruction in meditation, I think at some point it becomes very hard to say exactly what it is, except that it is some kind of manifestation of a discovery of self or a kind of taking apart of the self to see what's there. And I know, for example, I recently went to a ceremony at another Zen center and I ran into a bunch of people that I sat Tongario with at Tassajara and people that were in my practice period. And I immediately just felt this open vulnerability, in part because of the very deep work that one does when you do that kind of sitting there. And it reminded me that they don't remember my tears or the snot or the Kleenex. They just remember something that they think is Dana. And me as well with them, I don't remember their tears or their rages or whatever was said. What I remember is kind of abiding with one another as we went through whatever it is that we went through. So, you know, I know a lot of people feel like Zazen is this process where you work at it and you hope it's smooth. And, you know, I can't say what it's like for any of you, but I can just say in my case, it was a violent, episodic, unfortunate, and unhappy set of processes that were very challenging and difficult. And at the risk of being a little bit crude, I just want to tell you a little bit how difficult it is. You know, I know for me, I cherish Dana so much. I cherish this idea of this person who is this kind of academic, this kind of emotional person, a friend, and so on. And it's easy for me to say that to you, but the deconstruction part, I think, is kind of bears some evidence of how challenging that was. And some of you have seen some of this with me, from, particularly back in the early days here at Santa Cruz Zen Center. Allow me to kind of end with a somewhat unfortunate story. You know, many years ago, I think we don't give up the self easily. And often it's a wrenching process. It's usually not just one event. Usually it's a process, I think, that occurs over time. And it's easier to see when it's, some of it is behind you, as opposed to right when you're going through it, I think. I mean, I was very fond in the older days of saying, oh, I don't know, I have so much grief, so many people have died in my life, or I have so much sorrow. But as I think about it today, I don't exactly know that that's exactly what it was. I knew there was a lot of discharging of emotion. And forgive me, this is a somewhat kind of unpleasant story. But as I was thinking about how much I kind of cherish my own self, I remembered something that happened to me when I was a young professor at Santa Cruz. And I was on some big committee, and it was just me, you know, little young, new Dana at the university, and I was with all these kind of high-end full professors, and one of them was a dean who was very unpopular. And this dean loved to hunt, and like with a crossbow and a gun and all that. He actually used to live in my neighborhood, and he, because he was very, like, flamboyant about his hunting, particularly if he thought that you were in any way potentially a vegetarian or a vegan or some kind of granola, crunchy, Birkenstock-wearing Santa Cruzan, he would just, like, put it all out on the table. So for one of these big dinners, I arrived on time. My bad. I'm alone at the table with this man. And he starts in because he assumes I'm a hippie. And honestly, I just remember thinking, when are those other people going to show up? Anyway, he says, he's kind of talking to me about his own philosophy of hunting, which is to eat what he hunts and to use the hides and the skins and all of that. And, you know, I understood that. I know about that. And so I said, hey, Gary, that's a nice jacket. Did you kill the animal for that jacket? It was like a suede jacket with little tassels on it. It wasn't actually really cool, but I was being polite. So he leans over and he says, they don't give it up voluntarily. And that one line has just stuck with me all these years. And I think it's very apropos for my own kind of deconstruction of the self. Yeah, it wasn't a voluntary process for me. It wasn't like, oh, I want to be a Buddha. I want to be cool. I want to be nice. It was really, I have this stuff somewhere that I don't really know exactly what it is, but I'm drawn to this practice, maybe as a doorway to work on this. And like I say, I'm not done. So, you know, I don't want, in any way want you to think it's done. There will be snot and tears and Kleenex and rage and all of that stuff in the future. But I feel a little bit like this is such a deeply personal process for us. And while we may share some features of how this deconstruction takes place, it's not about the words going in through the mind that settle in the heart that allow us to try to forget the self. But I think it's a much more turbulent process. For some reason, I think that's helpful to say. Maybe this is helpful for me to say out loud. So still on the kind of my new precept of less is more. That's all I have. Would you like to have some discussion, or we could step out and... Reverend Toldy.
Well, you know, Dobie said we have to find our place where we are. And I take that absolutely literally. I don't think that's a metaphor at all. I think he's saying exactly the one that we find we are is the one we study, is the one we work to try to see through. You know, that's it.
Yeah.
So I just appreciate your honesty in sharing the reality of your experience at not moving, not turning away from discovering them.
Oh, I tried.
I haven't tried, but there you are.
Yeah. What do young people say? Man, that's ugly crying. Right? You know that term, ugly cry? It's like your face is scrunched up and you're... snot running down your face. That was me during practice period. I mean, I laughed a lot too, but and that has been me on these tons as well. So thank you, Kathy.
In this deconstruction of the self and the ego, having to have something there to begin to take apart. What is your sense of the role of the ego in the process of deconstruction? I mean, we don't disappear. I mean, Dana is still lovely, beloved, wonderful Dana. What are you doing with taking care of that which is functioning and valuable to the world?
You know, I think it's probably different for each one of us. I mean, I think I said at the outset that when I hear the words, my ego kind of goes, ding, 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 ding. You know, that's why I was an academic. I'm ready to light it up in various parts of my brain to have something to think about. I think it's probably different for other people where the mind can be, and the ego can be a real help for kind of the doorway or an entryway in. And maybe, you know, at different times, it's different things. I just know it in my own case that, you know, in some ways, and it was, you know, I don't think it had to do necessarily with the events in my life, although sometimes those events are very, they create the conditions for awareness. But I think sometimes you just, like, you get to that point. Well, you probably know this if you've ever had an argument or a fight with a loved one, a partner or a kid or... you're a parent, and you're just like on opposite ends of the earth. And sometimes that dissolves into rage, sometimes into tears. And in some ways, the ego is just, sure, it's there. But the expression, manifestation of this is a kind of falling apart, a deconstruction. So I'm probably not quite very accurate about this. Are you trying to figure out what to do with your ego?
Try to understand, what's the boundary for me of that self I'm trying to study and deconstruct?
You know, I think most of us want to be pretty well put together. That's the work of the ego, is to say, I've done this, I haven't done this, but I will do that. I'm good at this and this and this. And to take that artifice down, I think, is... You can't intend to do it. I think at some point it happens. Or maybe it never happens. One of the things that Frank Ostasecki was saying was, I know teachers who are extremely accomplished in terms of kind of their practice life, but who have poor interpersonal skills. Or I know teachers who have great interpersonal skills who are unable to do A, B, and C. And I think when he was writing that, he was saying that, you know, this idea that you forget the self or drop the self, it doesn't necessarily, it's an ideal, but it shows up in all these different ways. And all these different archetypes of people are part of that deconstruction, maybe. Sorry, kind of went on there. Thank you. Anybody else?
Yep.
Oh. Hi, Corinne.
Hi. Where is the fulfillment of all relations in this deconstruction? Is there any happening while this is going on, or is it not able to be fulfilled until?
Tell me what you mean by fulfillment of all relations.
Well, that's one of the chants.
So, you know, in Buddhist philosophy, we would say that kind of in ultimate reality, these things are fulfilled already. Are you asking me what does it feel like, or what is it? How does it manifest?
Well, you talk about interpersonal skills and conflicts with people, painful, like to have resolve, like to be open. How is that possible when you're deconstructing? Or is it just when your deconstruction is complete and then the dynamic of all that is?
I don't know. You know, I'm not much for thinking about this as a series of stages that occurs in a particular way. I think it's very... Well, one, it's very individual. Second, for me, it's been very episodic. It's a little bit like, you know, you can experience a moment of enlightenment, and then boom, the next minute that's gone. For most of us, it's a kind of fleeting experience. I just try not to make a mess. And I make some messes, but mainly I just try not to make a mess. Like, that's something I can kind of vow to do. Yeah. You know, I think one of the things is when you're, if you feel like you're in a kind of deconstructionist place and there's a lot of emotion or there's a lot of wildness, it's not a bad thing to say, I won't talk about that right now because I might say something I might regret tomorrow. That kind of thing. Did I answer your question? Oh, that's a pause. That means not really.
Well, in a way, I mean, your last suggestion, being present with your emotion as it is and owning it to somebody. But it doesn't... I guess maybe my question was a little more abstract. What it does point into when we talk about fulfillment of our relationships. And it seems that the energy, the dynamic, the stickiness that's involved won't disappear until we are recompleted.
I don't know about that. Who's to say that it's not going to be sticky and that's a fulfillment of all relations? I mean, I think each of us, as we kind of go through this process of meditation, our obligation is to do this work and to stay with it when possible. And this may sound self-centered, but I feel that, you know, what we do here is sit, study, do some service. And we do the best we can. I don't quite know what else to... Like if someone were to say to you, hey, Corinne, I think you're fulfillment of all relations. And then maybe Charlie says, I don't know. Right? How do we make that ascertainment?
We just bow to it.
We bow to it. Thank you. Anyone else? Kokyo.
So by deconstructing the self, do you mean whether it's tumultuous or a calm process, is that mean like we discover more that we're not who we think we are? Is that what you mean by the deconstruction?
Typically. Let's hope that happens. Kind of that solidity around I am this, and I am this kind of person who was raised this way, all of that, that can dissolve some, I think.
Yeah, and I think that's right, that can be a tumultuous or painful process, because sometimes we like the way we think of ourselves.
That's right. That's right. Right. And also, I think... How do I want to say this? You know, I'm just trying to, like, for me, work on this project that I call Dana, or not Dana. And, you know, honestly, I don't think that I will ever be able to fully deconstruct Dana. I can make less of a mess, maybe, here and there. But I think the ideal of it, for me, is very problematic, because then it just keeps me like, okay, I want to be more this way, that way. And that's not reckoning or dealing with what's this pile of stuff on the cushion.
You mean to be like a deconstructed thing or be another construction?
Probably, yeah. No end. No end. Maybe not even when you pass away. Yeah. Well, on that cheery note, should we step outside and say hello? Thank you all very much for being here.